Hello, this is Steve Wellner from Labyrinth of the Psychonaut, and you're listening to SyncBook Radio from thesyncbook.com.
We had just abandoned you.
Yeah, no, I had flipped off my Skype to offline for some reason and forgot about it. So,
all right. Well, Knowles is asking if we're ready.
Hell no.
Ready as we'll ever.
Let's see. Ba-ba-ba.
How's everybody doing?
Good.
Yeah, baby. I'm okay. Summer cold sucks, but what are you going to do?
Oh, I had that like 2 weeks ago, yeah.
Fucking A.
Hello?
Hello, did you bring the Phantom Zone with you?
What's the Phantom Zone?
I don't know. There was some crazy sound came in.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's the NSA listening in.
Big fans of the show, Chris. They love us.
Yeah, that's great.
We've actually been following their protocol. We named the show Always Record in honor of them, apparently.
Oh, terrific.
Apparently.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I don't know if you guys knew about Echelon, but
yeah,
Echelon was like 20 years ago. And I tell people that my first experience on the internet wasn't like on AOL or something. It was on a program called Timbuktu Remote. Have you ever heard of that program?
No.
Timbuktu Remote was a very early peer-to-peer internet program. I think it was maybe, I don't know if it was 24 or 56, like 24 BPS, not like 2400. But basically, even at very low, dial-in modem connection speed, you could poke around, you know, the hard drive of whoever you were talking to. So I never really was bought into the whole, oh, you know, you're totally anonymous on the internet kind of thing, because, you know, my experience taught me otherwise on an incredibly early and primitive program. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of, I think realizing the waters you're stepping into, and you can try and mitigate or control that presence as much as you want. But yeah, no illusions here.
Yeah, well, the other thing too is that, you know, most people who get paranoid about it don't realize that they're not important enough to needed to process their information. So anyway,
it's an interesting phenomenon, the way that if you were to speak about this when Facebook first started, if you're aware of where some of the funding came from, you'd be kind of laughed at in a lot of circles. And then it just takes some time to go by before it's like a generally accepted idea. I mean, it was in USA Today where they admitted that they can look into your, if you use Facebook, they can look into your computer beyond the internet. They can look into the sites that you've been on the last 3 days. If you just go on a site that has the Facebook link, like it's just opened up all doors to surveillance. But it's interesting the way that shifts relatively quickly now. Like, it's almost exponential, the degree of awareness around it. And so that's, I don't know quite what to make of all of that.
Well, from what I've heard, I was just reading an interesting article saying that kids already see Facebook as being uncool. That if you're like under 15 or 16, you don't use Facebook anymore.
Really?
Absolutely. Yes. My sister-in-law is just turned 13 a few months ago, and her parents had said she wasn't allowed to have a Facebook account till she was 13. And she was upset about it, and she, you know, kicked and screamed a little bit. But okay, she waited till her 13th birthday. 13th birthday comes, one of the first things she does, opens a Facebook account. Within one day, she says to me, she goes, "This is boring, I don't get it." And that was it. She hasn't used it since.
Yeah, I mean, kids use a computer on their phones now. They're not, like, using desktop appliances. So Facebook is kind of unwieldy on a telephone.
Does a 15-year-old even know how to use Facebook to their advantage?
I mean, they just want to talk to their friends. I mean, apparently Twitter is big with kids now. I mean, Twitter to me is like the ninth circle of hell. I was on there briefly, and I just despaired for the future of civilization. And actually, you know, a lot of the kind of just people just bugging out and just becoming completely irrational and all the kind of behaviorisms that we're seeing don't surprise me, because I think Twitter is the driving factor behind a lot of that. I think it encourages people, you know, because it's so hard to get anybody to pay attention to you because it's just this blizzard of ASCII just flying by that people just are constantly acting out. And people, you know, kids especially, I don't know, it's bizarre. I think it's very unhealthy.
I'm laughing, but I agree.
One of these guys who was like reading Mondo 2000 back, you know, in 1990 and stuff, and you know, thought Wired was like the son of Sam coming in to just destroy everything. But I am no longer a techno-utopian by any stretch of the imagination, because I now see that it's just being used to just slice everyone up into just, it's atomizing everything. And, you know, like I said, I mean, a lot of the behavior that we're seeing, you're seeing particularly young people just acting out in just bizarre ways, just like strange kind of freakish behaviors. I mean, kids are always going to act like that, but just it seems to be accelerating. It's because they're so desperate for anybody to pay attention to them, because it's so hard to get anybody to pay attention to you on things like Twitter and Tumblr and all this kind of stuff.
So would you prefer an arcane revival? Would you prefer things to go more in the complete opposite direction?
You know, I've been around the block enough to see the things shake themselves out. You know, I remember, I feel like I'm in a rerun. This era reminds me so much of like 20 years ago. It's almost exactly the same. It's a rerun. It's like a LARP. But you know, things. You had this whole thing with zines and indie bands and all this whole thing, and it just got to be ridiculous because everybody thought they could play and they couldn't, and everybody thought they had something interesting to say and they didn't, and what ended up happening is that whole situation accelerated and just reached this critical mass where nobody could keep anything straight anymore. That what came of that? Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, you know, it just, things over-democratized to the sense that they lead to unbelievable top-down centralization. I'm sure that Oswald Spengler had something to say about this. I'll have to see, but it's, you know, maybe this is the Caesarism that he talked about, but
yeah,
you know, the whole grassroots reaches such a critical mass. Everybody thinks they can do that people start to think that nobody can do it except for, you know, what is approved by, you know, the official stamp, so to speak. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. And we certainly don't need more centralization and top down and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I don't think that the kids today really have a lot to say, because I don't think they've had any interesting life experience to draw upon.
I think that's kind of what Bill was hinting at, and this is something we can touch on as we go on, and I think we'll continue to touch on, is the idea that, and again, not necessarily trying to promote a techno-utopia by any stretch of the imagination here. I also found, I was on Twitter for, I think, 2 weeks, and I just couldn't bear it.
It's an abomination. It's awful.
But the idea when he asked, you know, does a 15-year-old know how to use these things to their advantage? That's the other thing. Like, I think one of the dangerous trends with maybe what leads to a Backstreet Boys, at least in one extent, is the big corporations are trying to figure out, oh, kids think Facebook is uncool, so what, as if they know, like, they're the future, so they're going to lead us into technology or how to better understand or better use technology. So if a 15-year-old thinks Facebook is uncool, then the 30-year-old or 50-year-old should think so too, and we should follow. I've seen this on some news programs or, you know, tech people who are following technology trends, where they're trying to understand, okay, so then what is the next thing, without at any point trying to figure out how did we actually use the technology we have. And I think guys, I'm hoping guys like us are figuring out how to use the internet for research, networking, and I don't mean networking particularly in a business sense, but in a, you know, information and things like that, where we can hash out some of these ideas. Is there a way to, you know, sort of remind, maybe that's the what an older guys can bring to this conversation, is there a way to actually utilize this stuff in a more productive manner?
Well, I think what happens, and I see this a lot when I look at, say, like a liberal site like Salon, is that there's an expectation that the millennials are just like us, or the millennials are just like the baby boomers, or the millennials are just like, you know, you name it. And they don't realize that these kids have been mediated since they were born. And they don't have any context that exists outside of media. And you see kids that they'll be at a concert and they're not watching the concert, they're staring at their phones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, do you know what I'm saying? They'll be on the beach and they're not looking at they're not experiencing, everything is mediated. Everything is filtered. So I don't think they necessarily have anything to say because everything has been said to them and for them. You know, it's a very interesting situation where, you know, back in the 20s, in the post-war period, you had what was called the so-called lost generation, where you had a lot of people who were really totally disillusioned by World War One, which was just this total slaughter and madness. And these people didn't want to, you know, follow in this continuity of Western civilization that had been handed down to them, because they saw what it came to, just people who were essentially cousins slaughtering each other on the fields of, you know, Verdun or whatnot. But I think what we have now is, I think we're going to have a true lost generation. We're going to have a true lost generation that just will not leave a mark, will not leave any great art or, you know, great novels or great films or anything like that, because it's just, they don't need to. You know what I'm saying? When I was a kid, I was in the hardcore punk rock scene, and there was just such violence and energy and intensity, because it was a lot of kids who just felt, you know, trapped, who just felt there was no way out. They were so tired of living in the shadow of their big brothers and their big brother's music, and you know, they were, you know, kids like myself who were latchkey kids and just felt cheated. And you know, I mean, it was an incredible scene because there was an impetus behind it. You can't reproduce that with kids who grow up in happy households, you know, who don't grow up in a town like Boston, which was, you know, a mess in the 70s, or New York or Los Angeles. I mean, these towns went through really tough phases that these kids grew up in. So, you know, when you grow up in paradise, it's very hard to be inspired to create anything. Do you understand what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
I agree with you, but I feel like there's like simultaneous realities happening at once there. I feel like it's hard to take an ultimate position because the superficiality of the paradise is such that, you know, and I don't pretend to know what's going to happen. Like, I don't know what's going to happen out of this and for people to like where this is all headed and what will come out of that. Like, there's huge potential and possibilities and all kinds of things.
I think that's in the future. I think that we're entering a period, you know, of economic crisis. And I don't see that this generation of kids is going to have a lot to say about that. I see the next generation is going to be more pivotal because they're going to grow up in a more difficult situation. You know, in some regards, these kids grew up, you know, post 9/11, you know, during the economic crisis. But, you know, I grew up poor. You know what I'm saying? We were on food stamps and free lunches. And
there's still poor people out there.
Yeah, I understand that. But I'm saying it's all a relative situation because when you have access to, say, cable TV, you don't feel as poor because you're medicated from it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I hear what you're saying, and I'm kind of playing slight devil's advocate just for the fact that I feel like we are making a generalization.
But it's impossible to, you know, in this context, to do anything else.
I mean, sure.
But when you are amused, when you are not bored, you know, people really underestimate the power of boredom and just the oppressive nature of boredom. When you are not bored, you don't feel as poor. You understand what
I'm
saying?
Yeah, that's why I think music is such a big part of your language, right? Because in wherever you are, if the right band is playing, it doesn't... numbers and sense and status, it all disappears.
Hopefully.
Because I, you know, just to relate to you, Chris, you know, one of your big bands, I'm sure growing up, was Minor Threat.
Yeah, well, yeah, I put a picture of myself on stage with them.
Yeah, I love that photo. And my second, see, I'm kind of like in the paradise realm of growing up, you know, suburban kid, and my second concert that I ever went to at the age of 17 was a Fugazi show at the Oak Theater in Chicago. Uh-huh. And how I ended up at that show is I don't even really know. I think it was a friend of my sister's from college. And I enter into this world that I'm not even ready for, and I see those guys on stage, and I see the crowd in front of them, and I see them play for an hour and 40 minutes, and it just completely changes my life. But in probably a completely different direction than the way getting on stage with Minor Threat did for you. But the common link in there is the energy and the music and the language that you know, regular people in front of my eyes were creating out of thin air. It's just, it's stunning.
Minor Threat show and a Fugazi show were two entirely different things. I mean, not entirely dissimilar, like not completely unrelated. But there's just, it's very hard to, the music is very much different. The audience is different. The expectations are different. I mean, a Minor Threat show is basically like Lord of the Flies, you know. So, you know, and a Fugazi show is, you know, very exciting and very shamanic in a sense, but the audience is older, it's more educated, it's more there to soak up the experience rather than be acting within the experience.
Well, in 1992, when I got there, the people owning the center of the audience were skinheads in red suspenders and swastikas on their arms, mixing with punk rockers, mixing with college students. And I'm just saying, in 1992, it was this bizarre... church of people coming to it, flocking to it with intensity, all for different reasons. And I just wasn't prepared for something so real. And to kind of bring this back to our discussion of kids today, like you said, I had no internet videos of Fugazi. I had no knowledge of them in any media source. You know what I mean? This was completely concealed. It was a complete occult community to me from my position. And nowadays, like you said, kids are so mediated that what is out there that they can fall into that they have absolutely no idea exists? It's very rare, it would seem.
Well, when somebody presents that to them, it's going to be dangerous. You know, it's yes. going to be batting down the hatches. When somebody figures out how to give them something that they can't put on their computer screens, it's going to be
absolutely
an amazing thing. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote, you know, I will confess, I mean, it wasn't really my project. I wrote this book called The Secret History of Rock and Roll, and it was basically an assignment. And it was an assignment that came with a huge number of limitations and strictures. And, you know, if I was left to my own devices, it would have been a much different book. It was a book that I had to write, you know, not necessarily in a straitjacket, but with other people's, you know, format and regulations to consider. But, you know, the thing that I wrote and why I probably will want to revisit this is that, you know, what you describe at that Fugazi show and what I experienced, you know, every weekend in the hardcore scene, I was just stunned and amazed when I went back and read a lot of the accounts of the ancient mystery religions, how it was exactly the same. I mean, I'm not saying kind of like similar, you know, sort of the same themes. I'm talking exactly the same, no difference at all. You know, when you talk about these groups like the Korobantes and the Kharites, who are basically hardcore, heavy metal, whatever you want to name it, they were noisemakers. They came in dressed in armor, playing these guitar instruments, these huge metallic guitars, like they were basically harps that were gigantic, made of iron. They would make this incredible sound. They used their shields as percussion instruments. They just would come in and just make this racket that would scare the shit out of people who were all tripping balls on goblin, you know, wheat roster, whatever the hell they were on. I just was amazed. I'm just like, you got, and you know, and then you have like the Mithraeus with shaved heads and X's on the hands. I'm like, wait a minute, are you kidding me? That's exactly what I experienced in 1981 in Boston. I mean, it's the exact same thing. You know, straight edge. The Mithraeus, when they weren't tripping balls, were very strict about their lifestyle. I mean, you know, very ascetic. And that was the whole thing, because really what the mystery religions were really about is training your whole being so you wouldn't have a bad trip, because this experience was so intense, it could go really badly. Because they would scare the shit out of you when you were, like, tripping your balls off.
Do you think that it's accurate to say that there's a pretty, it's convenient enough to divide the forward momentum of the last 2,000 years of mystery religions and history religions, that's an accurate statement? Is there value to that?
You know, it's so impossible to separate, because the mystery religions all had exoteric churches that were exactly the same as the Catholic Church. You know, all these distinctions that we make are artificial distinctions that we put with the hindsight of history and modern history, where basically our religions have been secularized and operate within a secular Darwinian framework. You know, I mean, the Catholic Church up until maybe the 13th or 14th century, you know, was basically practicing witchcraft. I mean, it was basically a form of white magic. It's funny, because the fundamentalists will throw around terms like Babylon mystery religion. I mean, they don't really know what they're saying. They all get that from a guy named Alexander Hyslop. But it's, you know, they're essentially right. I mean, it was Catholicism up until it became more intellectualized and the philosophy of the Renaissance became more predominant in it, was you know, just folk witchcraft. And there are still aspects of it in more primitive forms that are. You know, people see things like Santeria and voodoo and some of these other practices as being, oh, this bizarre and, you know, this corruption by the African slaves and everything. That's not it at all. I mean, first of all, Santeria and voodoo, all these traditions, they're all imported from Egypt. And that's been documented. They're all Egyptian mystery religions that were adopted by West African slave. I mean, you know, people who became slaves, but they were indigenous tribes who were missionized by the Egyptians and were also missionized by tribes who were expelled when the Hyksos were expelled. Mm-hmm. So it's all in the DNA. This is why I'm like really fascinated by what I call the idea of cultural DNA. Because, you know, when something like rock and roll popped back up after the war, after this conflagration, you know, and pops up at the same time with, you know, with the flying saucer flaps and all these other kinds of interesting things happening at the same time, that's not an accident. It's something triggered in our DNA. It's a program, like literally a program that gets triggered. And this other program of consciousness takes over, you know, it's all contingent on what's happening in the world around us. You know, I don't think it's accidental that things like the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library all showed up at the end of World War II. I don't think that's accidental at all. It's all part of this.
That's occidental.
Can I ask you to clarify that point though? Because I think some people will take that in different ways, and maybe, and again, this maybe is speculation, but is, when you say, is it a program, is it something that, when you say it's in our DNA, is this essentially human nature, that when this happens, this will activate this sort of cultural response? Or are you saying
Look at it this way. Okay, let's look at it this way. Let's put this on a microcosmic level.
Sure.
All right, you live in a neighborhood, right? You live in a neighborhood and people just basically let each other be. They don't really pay attention to one another. They just sort of go about their own business. They say hello. They're friendly to each other. I mean, it's all right. It's pleasant. Somebody experiences a major crisis, a fire, something really terrible happens to one of the families on the block. A program kicks in. A different program kicks in. Something, you know, people begin to come together. People, their consciousness basically changes. They don't see themselves as just, you know, neighbors anymore. They see themselves as part of a unit, and they pull together, you know, to take care of one another. I mean, I have a great example of this. There's a guy down the street from me who, you know, he kind of was a very nice guy. I really liked him a lot, but he was sort of involved in some business dealings that people didn't really look too well upon. But he got really sick. And he had four kids. You know, he had a family to support. He got really sick with cancer that just ravaged him and eventually killed him. You know, and even though, like, you know, family wasn't like everybody's favorite, but everybody in the town pulled together and had like this big benefits and all the stuff because a different program kicked in. Okay, now that's a microcosmic level. That's just one community, one neighborhood. I believe that the same thing happens on larger, you know, on a larger human level. And there are, you know, parts of our consciousness that exist outside ourselves. You know, consciousness is energy. The entire earth is energy. You know, we are surrounded by energy. And our consciousness is just another form of that energy. Do you understand what I'm saying? So we don't know whether this program is in our genes or whether it's in the, what they used to call the ether, or it's both. It could very well be both. I have no compunctions with accepting the fact that it's, you know, a both and situation rather than either or. But, you know, you just see how this happens. And this is why I'm saying that, like, today feels so familiar to me because it all feels like 1992, 1993 all over again to me. It's all the same sort of cultural malaise and acting out, and then a lot of things that we saw back then, you know, just repeating itself. It's a program. It's just everything is cyclical. Everything is programmed. But it's not a simple program. It's not, you know, people like to reduce things, but I don't think it can be reduced. I think it's more complex, and I think there's, you know, the more you understand the complexity of all these different systems, you know, the more you understand that it is a program, but the less inclined you are to try and necessarily try to wrap your head around it, because I think it's just too big. And I think things like synchronicity and symbolism and all these things, they all play a part of this, because they are all part of this program. I think it is in literally in our DNA. I think in our DNA is consciousness and intelligence and memory and a lot of these things. And I think science is kind of going there. They're not comfortable with it. They're very uncomfortable with it, because that sort of leads to the question of how did it get there, but it will get there.
I saw an example of what you're talking about, of a large community coming together when I was a kid in 1989, and there was a massive earthquake that happened here. And what's that?
Where are you?
Near San Francisco. So I'm in Santa Cruz, but... Okay. And it was incredible. Like, people like were opening up their shops, people that had shops, and were like, take what you need, pay me later, like whatever, like everything else aside. And so like that is something that I've kept with me through much of my life, as like an example of recognizing how when people are giving me kind of doomsday scenarios, I'm like, people have humanity and it comes out under stress, and they care about their neighbors, and I've seen that happen firsthand, and so I know that. But just to point out, this is significant on a synchronicity level. I remember when I was a kid going to the shoe store before the earthquake and seeing these large billboards of the San Francisco Giants versus the Oakland A's, and there would be the two sides, and they called it the Battle of the Bay. And I remember this buildup towards the Battle of the Bay. And I was asking my dad the significance of it. And he's like, well, there's teams all over the country, and it just so happens that it's Oakland versus San Francisco. And so I remember when I was a kid, after the earthquake, watching on the television the coverage of the Bay Bridge that connected the San Francisco to Oakland breaking in the middle. And it's in my mind as a child, having the image, the billboard of the two sides against each other. And it broke in the middle, and I was like, I remember thinking to myself, how does that happen? Like, that's like, and I bet you that was my first, like, real profound, like, experience of synchronicity, and being like, oh, it was the tension. Like, it was the tension between the sides, and that we're connected to the planet. And it was just this whole kind of revelation around that. And so, yeah, and it turned out to be a very, I look back on that, not the earthquake itself, which was devastating, but everything that followed with nothing but just positivity, because of the way that people were to each other.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's the program that kicks in. I saw the same thing, you know, just recently when the superstorm came, you know, tear-assing through here. So, I mean, it's definitely, you know, it's interesting, though, because I bet if... You know, once that situation becomes normalized, then that initial burst, that initial part of the program begins to sort of wear down, and things start to change. People begin to get irritable. People get sick of it, you know. People get sick of the whole, you know, living within a crisis. They want a return to normality, you know. Sure. That's why it's always very important to restore normality as quickly as possible, because... You know, if you do have a situation like that earthquake, if there wasn't that kind of recovery, and I think this might be part of the programming, might be part of, you know, the unconscious programming in the DNA. If there wasn't that kind of recovery, then I think that, you know, that can lead to disaster. I mean, you know, civilizations have been known to break down because of natural disasters. You know, and I'm sure that at first they had that kind of rallying. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, Pompeii and Herculaneum, which were destroyed by, what was it, Mount Etna? Or no, it was Vesuvius, I'm sorry. You know, there are a lot of theorists who believe that, you know, the destruction of the Western Empire was due to some sort of volcanic event or some sort of major environmental catastrophe.
So you mentioned this recent superstorm, and I'm currently living in North Carolina, but been a New Yorker my whole life. Just moved down here a few months ago, and I was in New York for that storm. Now, where I was living, I lived in Queens, Elmhurst, Jackson Heights, so it's a little more landlocked. So I didn't see the most I had was some power flickering. I had running water and essentially electricity through the whole thing.
You're lucky.
I know. I have people who live just a few towns over that lost everything. So I was very, very, very fortunate. But so around me, what I noticed is in this sort of space that didn't get it as hard, there was a lot more strife. People who couldn't get gasoline. I mean, I don't drive, but to see huge lines in front of every gas station, people fighting. You know, the search for resources kicks in and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's another part of the program. You know, I think, you know, that's the kind of program, part of the program that kicks in later, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's when, you know, after that initial we're all in this together kind of feeling wears off, then it becomes, you know, I've got to get my car out of the garage, you know.
Right.
It becomes sort of, you know, every man for himself, because, you know, your survival instincts, which I think, you know, are very primate, begin to take over. I mean, I remember during the superstorm, and we got clobbered here. I mean, my family, you know, my home, we were very, very fortunate, almost eerily so, believe me, because people all around us. You know,
trust me, that's how I felt. I felt like completely blessed seeing what happened right around me.
Yeah. So, but, you know, going to, you know, the huge Walmart in Morristown and seeing the shelves completely empty was like, you got to be kidding me, you know, like there was no food left. And that's like something out of like a 70s disaster film, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, in hearing people, you know, hit having fist fights at gas stations, like you said, and all that kind of thing. I mean, you know,
how do you think smartphones implemented with internet work as a social lubricant in these situations? Do you think fistfights could have turned into riots without it? Or do you think that, what do you think the impact is of that technology into these occurrences that will always occur? Like, we'll never not have natural disasters.
Well, here's what I think. I think they act as pacifiers, which is important. You know, when the signal goes down, though, which it did here for several days, they're useless. And if you can't get, you know, electricity in your house, I mean, there are people around here who didn't have electricity for a month. They're useless. But, you know, if you just want to play, you know, tic-tac-toe or whatever the hell, or asteroids or whatever you want to play, you know, they're good. You know, there's something about video games and stuff. They're like a hypnotic pacifier. You know, it would be interesting to see somebody do like a neurological study on the effects of something like Tetris or something like that. And, you know, which is still popular, which blows my mind. You know, and how these images of these, you know, these falling geometric shapes have some sort of pacifying effect on the, you know, the autonomic parts of the brain. And that's what I think happens. But, you know, when they do work, it's, you know, you find out where you can get gas, you find out where you can get food, you know, you find out, you know, who's got, which library is open to charge your you know, your cell phone and your laptop and all that kind of stuff. You find out where you can go take a shower, you know, things like that, you know, just like the basic necessities of life, you know, which were very important around here.
Can we take this in a more symbolic direction? This is, we can go one of two ways. Is one, I'd like to discuss going to like David's example of the Bay. What is the symbolic meaning of New York City and particularly the subways being flooded? We've had all these, for lack of a better term, rituals go on with floating Anubis up the Hudson River and putting the space shuttle there and all these different things coinciding with essentially a flooding of the Nile event and an Atlantean New York. If we're going to put the puzzles together in a Tetris fashion, there is the pacifying effect, but there's also, as you yourself, I mean, really put it more profoundly than I've ever heard put, the idea that when you start to understand certain symbolism, it opens up other areas of your brain. So certainly it can pacify, but it can also unlock certain things within us.
I have this horrible feeling, and you know, sometimes I wonder, there are certain people who feel this as well, that people in the know, you know, the people in the elites, not necessarily like the banking elites, but I mean like people in places like NASA or, you know, the scientific elites, you know, the sort of gray area between, you know, the ruling class and the scientific overclass are afraid. They're afraid of, you know, that we are in trouble. And it might just be, you know, and it's interesting too, because you can never fully take these things literally. It might be their own fears projected onto the world, you know. But I believe that there is a sense, an apocalyptic sense, among this class. You know, that's why we're seeing things like the seed bank and things like that. I think a lot of these rituals, they remind me of the Wicker Man.
Mm.
I think they're like pacifying rituals. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Have
you been to Burning Man?
No, I've not been to Burning Man. I don't think I'd do very well there. I've got some medical issues, so I think I'd probably be begging to get out the first day. No, I think that there's, you know, there are a couple ways. You know, the problem with a lot of conspiracy material out there is that it comes, you know, basically from either a neo-Nazi or a fundamentalist perspective. So they always, you know, paint everything from their perspective. And, you know, I'm not saying that they're always wrong in their interpretations or whatever, but I think a lot of these rituals, if that in fact what they are, and some of them are obvious, you know, like the Anubis down the river and things, I think they remind me of like pacifying rituals that, you know, the whole idea, people really forget what paganism was about. You know, neo-paganism is like such a corruption. You know, paganism was really dark, heavy, serious business. It was because you were afraid. You were afraid that the crops would fail. You were afraid that all your children would die in a bad winter. You were afraid that there would be a drought that would kill off your entire village. You were at the mercy of nature. That's what paganism was really about.
Paganism means civilian or villager. It means the populace, basically.
Yeah, it was basically, you know, the rural people trying to appease the forces of nature. I just recently watched The Dark Secret of Harvest Home. If you guys haven't watched that, you really should. It's kind of a piece with The Wicker Man, but it's a little more delineated. It's less comical. And it explores the whole idea of Celtic nature religion a little more deeply. But it really is about, like, you know, if the crops fail, and both stories, interestingly, take place after a blight. If the crops fail, you know, nature has to be appeased. And I think that, whether or not it's accurate scientifically or whether or not it is a projection of their own anxieties, I think that there is definitely a sense among certain parts of the scientific overclass that the planet is in serious trouble. You know, I mean, whether or not you believe in global warming, things like that, they do. They really do. They're not just saying it because there's some sort of overarching agenda. Maybe some people are, but there is a very hardcore people that really believe that the planet is in very serious trouble.
Do you think, and, Chris, that possibly, sorry to interrupt, that on some level that global warming is kind of like humanity's final exam? That this is what all our knowledge and technology and communication is for, is that global warming is the test that we have to pass?
I don't know, you know, and I'll tell you something. I had a very interesting experience back last year. Was it last year? No, I'm sorry, it was 2011 now. There was what we called the Halloween storm. And what had happened is that there was a very mild and hot, rainy summer. So the trees, and the fall was also very hot and rainy. So the trees really kept their dress late into the season. They didn't lose the leaves well into October. And as a matter of fact, I think a lot of the trees were still green at that. Leaves were still green because of the heat and the rain. So then things just like turned on a dime, and it became very, very cold. And then all of a sudden, there was a blizzard. And the problem with that is that when there's a blizzard and all the trees still have the leaves on, they can't deal with the weight. So my son and I went out there because a tree was about to fall on my wife's car. It was terrifying. And we're listening to tree branches snap. I mean, like literally explode. It sounded, and I'm not even remotely exaggerating, it sounded like a 4th of July fireworks. That's how many, that's how many trees and branches were exploding. It was surreal. It was terrifying. And I was sitting there realizing, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. There's nothing science can do about this. There's nothing they can do. You know, I mean, we hear a lot of things about controlling the weather. And I'm sure that there are certain kind of tricks they can do to maybe create a certain storm in a certain area, whatever. But a situation like this, there's nothing that can be done. So something like global warming, we don't realize how small our footprint is on this planet. We don't realize how big this planet is, how most of this planet is ocean, how unbelievably powerful the ocean is. So if it is our final exam, we're in serious trouble. Nah. I really hope it isn't. I mean that in all sincerity, because I just don't see us passing.
The Aramaic for atonement or redemption is the same word for purge. And if you've ever taken ayahuasca, you have a relationship to the meaning of that for sure. But I could see global warming as like a massive purging of what's not serving the planet. I'm down. I don't mind that. I don't object to that completely.
But in these sorts of scenarios, what ends up getting purged? I mean, I would hate to see, the rich guys with the seed banks survive and the poor people who have nothing but Monsanto products on their shelves.
They're gonna die. Yeah. It's not about that. Like, there's kind of a joke, like there's no one's living forever. Like, it's like the Skeksis saying we will live forever, and then they become one with the sticks as the Xerxes. Like, there's something bigger going on here. I think that's like you're trying to hold on to something, and if you're looking at life from that perspective in the first place, then you're already doomed, right? In your own way. So I don't know.
Let's put this perspective, because I want to address what you just said. There was just a situation in Egypt yesterday, and anywhere from, I think I read up to maybe 500 people were killed.
That's what I heard, too.
What's that?
That's what I heard, too.
Yeah, because the Egyptian military was just going through this giant plaza with bulldozers. You know, millions of people had gathered in this plaza to protest the coup, and they were just like bulldozing people. It was literally like something, if you've ever seen the movie Soylent Green,
yeah,
exactly, a replay of that film. The parts of the world that are most subject to changes in climate are also the most overpopulated or populated, depending on how you want to look at it. And I would say overpopulated because, okay, well, somebody would say, well, they have all this land mass. It's not about land mass. It's about water tables. It's about food supply. It's about resource allocation. You know, there are all these variables that go into it. You know, Egypt, I think Egypt has 80 million people right now. And scientists believe that Egypt could, you know, comfortably accommodate 12. You know, the 12 million people could live in Egypt comfortably, you know, with a decent standard of living. But they're almost, you know, they're seven times that amount. So if the climate does begin to change, you know, we are going to see massive upheaval. And we are not going to be insulated from it. You know, there are no, boundaries anymore. It is going to affect all of us. You know, the planet is all connected, you know, for better or worse now. It's, you know, you will not be able to hide from the chaos and the war and the destruction that is coming to all of us. There's just, like, I never wish for bad things to happen, you know, because I have too much experience to know that, you know, it never is contained, that the pain is always spread. And you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't know if it's a product of my condition, but when I see human suffering, it really affects me.
Empathy. That's a good thing.
You know, I wish I was less empathetic. I do. And I think a lot of the problems that I have is, is getting triggered by other people's, discord or their unhappiness or their trauma or whatever, you know, I mean, empathy is not, symbolism. We keep getting to this stuff, but we want to talk about symbolism.
Well, I guess before we do that, I think it would be prudent to in the points that were just raised about all this sort of stuff. What do you say to the people who are listening right now and saying we have, you know, hidden Tesla technology or whatever it might be that we actually? These numbers of when we say we can only support these many people comfortably, the people who are listening right now going, that's not true. We have the technology or the resources to take care of more people.
Well, here's the problem. Technology is only as good as it is feasible. As you know, technology requires energy. It requires things that exist outside of blueprints. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, Tesla was a genius who could put a lot of things on paper. But there are a lot of great things that exist on paper that just do not exist in a practical sense. And I just, I don't believe it. I don't believe we have flying saucers that can, go to other galaxies. I mean, I don't believe, we hear a lot of these things, a lot of these speculations about hidden technologies. I don't believe it. Why don't I believe it? Because if we had these technologies, they'd be used.
But scarcity equals control, right?
So no, I'm not saying that you and I would use them. I'm saying that they would be used, in the field of battle. They would be used to put an end to the kind of control issues that the elites are dealing with. You know what I'm saying? If all this technology existed, we would not be having this conversation right now. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just thought it was prudent to raise that question.
If I think people feel so disempowered that they feel the need to project omnipotence, you know, because what it does is that it lets them off the hook. And this, I think, is too much, you know, a feature of conspiracy thinking, that people feel so disempowered that they need to completely disempower themselves. They need to completely absolve themselves of you know, the conduct of responsibility for their own lives.
That it was on that the church was founded, as we know the church today, which was the idea of the scapegoat was kind of a joke, apparently. Like, I was looking at texts from the 15th century with my teacher talking about the scapegoat idea, where you have a goat, you project your skins onto it, it could be a sheep, and then you murder it. Either fucking push it off a cliff, you slaughter it in some kind of way, and then you're like, woo, there my sins went. What a relief. And that's what Christianity is based off of, is this idea from Judaism of the goat. Like,
oh, I'm sure it goes back a long time before Judaism.
Oh, I'm sure it does. But I'm saying, like, that in terms of, like, you know, it's direct on that level. Like, we know that much. If you want to find an earlier source, I'm sure you could probably find it. But just this idea of projecting your mistakes, your missings of the mark onto an external source, and people eat that up. They need that. They're like, okay, and they don't care if it's a fantasy. They don't care about anything other than if it gives them a sense of relief. And if they get that relief, then they can go about their lives. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I just, you know, I find that I understand it, but I find that those people just create so much discord and unhappiness because their need to completely, you know, disengage entirely and just make everything hopeless is so powerful and so overwhelming that, you know, when you're trying to have a conversation about anything, they just tend to, you know, interject with their own anxieties. And, you know, I mean, I am very much a person who has a conspiratorial, you know, view of the world, but I don't see it as like a religious kind of thing. To me, it's just basic human nature. I mean,
that's a coping mechanism.
What I'm saying is that to me, human beings are essentially corrupt, and corrupt human beings make decisions together in secret. I mean, it's very simple. I mean, people are convicted on the charges of conspiracy every day in practically every courthouse in the world. You know, the problem with you know, it's like, I always say that whenever a term like conspiracy is capitalized, it becomes degraded. You know what I'm saying? Becomes a form of religion. And that's where I think the problem is. And I think a lot of people, you know, it's interesting because I think fundamentalism programmed a lot of people to think a certain way, but it didn't program how to, you know, how to actually cope in the real world. It just programmed on, you know, how to hate things, you know what I'm saying? And how to fear things. But it didn't program them on how to, you know, how to cope with life and how to operate in the real world. And now that the fundamentalism program has been, you know, it's basically breaking down here and being exported to other parts of the world, you know, all these people are sort of like, you know, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to think? And it's funny how a lot of these people are sort of, you know, becoming atheists, and they act exactly like fundamentalists.
It's the same thing. You're taking an ultimate position.
They behave and think and act like fundamentalists. They just have found a new fundamentalism to believe. And, you know, it's very damaging because I know one of your questions is, you know, the whole fundamentalist program. Yes, it absolutely was a mind control program. There's no question about it. It was started by a man named John Foster Dulles in the media post-war environment. He found a hellfire and brimstone preacher named Billy Graham, mm-hmm. and put all his money behind him and enlisted a guy named William Randolph Hearst to push him in all his newspapers. He had a chain of newspapers all across the country. And, you know, the program just grew and grew and grew. And any time there was some sort of political, you know, battle with something like a union or, you know, the Red Scare or whatever, the fundamentalists would come in and rewrite the program. I mean, a classic example of this is, you know, the Berkeley situation, the free speech and all this. That's where the Jesus Freak movement started. It was started by the CIA. They openly bragged about how they started it, you know, and that's really the basis of what we came to know as the evangelical movement in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, the cults, groups like Jim Jones and the Unification Church and things like this, these were all laboratories. This is where all they developed all the techniques. And it's stunning if you ever read, you know, groups like John Hagee's church or some of these mega churches, Rick Warren, Joel Osteen, they all use the same techniques that the 60s and 70s cults asked. You know, even secular cults, which is amazing, because they were all funded and developed by the CIA. And as soon as, you know, the ideas were ready for prime time, the cults were all dissolved. It's an amazing story.
It's funny. Here's just a personal thing. Where I live right now, I'm one block away from this highway that's called the Billy Graham Freeway or something like that, which makes me want to puke every time I pass it. But then it's funny is on either side of the highway, you know, there's like adopt a street, like to clean up the street. It's the Western North Carolina Atheists. So you have Billy Graham and the Atheists have kind of both picked out this spot. And I think it's so funny to me is this sort of, again, it's either fundamentalist materialists or fundamentalist religions. Do you think the fundamentalist materialists, like the psy-cop and all this sort of stuff, do you think that's also part of an agenda?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and, you know, and this is funny, too, because, you know, I don't know if this is a good sign or a bad sign, because obviously, you know, who was ever sponsoring psy-cop has obviously pulled their sponsorship, because psy-cop is getting pummeled now, too. I mean, I don't know if you've been following this.
Sure, but, yeah.
There's been the skeptic atheist civil war, and the atheists are going after PsyCop, which is now called CFI, with hammer and tongs because of, I mean, they're not even scratching the surface because they're not going after people like Randy and Vern Bullough with their interests, so to speak. But, you know, one of the major PsyCop people now, we'll just call them PsyCop because I love that because it's basically a cipher for thought police.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
There's a guy named Benjamin Radford, you know, who turns out was sexually harassing this woman, and he basically got a slap on the wrist from PsyCop, and you know, it's turning into this big disaster, and all these lawsuits are flying, and it's, you know, it's turning out that the PsyCop and, you know, the people around it, you know, basically were using this movement as a, you know, it's a sexual predation, you know. I don't even know the term for it. I mean, they were basically preying, you know, any women that were showing up, you know, were basically, you know, because these groups were mostly men, these conventions were mostly men, and these women were just prey. And, you know, a lot of men are like, oh, going, oh, you're just being extremist feminist. And this is one of the, you know, the rare examples where I'm like, no, I've seen this. I've seen this at comic conventions. I've seen this in geek culture, you know, where women are just seen as fuck toys. And I think that that's exactly what's going on with these men who are basically narcissistic, predatory personalities. But it's interesting because, you know, in the past, CFI, you know, somebody would swoop in and hush a lot of people up and pay people off, but it's not happening. So, but, you know, Paul Kurtz, who was actually the founder, I mean, he was forced out of PsyCop. And PsyCop was basically created. What had happened is that you had, and I sort of wrote about this in my Secret Star Trek series, you had this very interesting sort of weird situation where people in the CIA and the military were messing around with psychics and UFOs and all this crazy stuff, and which was fine. I mean, it had been going on for a lot longer than, you know, the early 70s, been going on since the late 40s. I would very much argue that it was very much part of MKUltra, which I think was the mind control aspect of it was just a cover.
There's a ton of subdivisions of MKUltra. There's a whole lot of them. And
yeah,
some of them
I think, you know, it's funny because when you look at the old stories of the Alchemist, you know, the whole cover story is like, you know, when they wanted to get funding, oh, we'll turn lead into gold. And I think MKUltra basically, you know, when they wanted to get funding, so, oh, we'll give you a mind control technology. But they were obviously had much stranger and weirder interests than that. But anyhow, what had happened, and really what it boils down to, is a guy named Andrea Puharich, who discovered a guy named, you know, people know Uri Geller, you know, the Israeli Mossad agent, quote, psychic. And what it had, the reason why PsyCop was created is that all these stories were leaking out. A lot of it was because of Puharich. Puharich was basically, you know, he wrote a book on Uri Geller where he's basically spilling the beans and letting people know, you know, all this crazy stuff that the government was paying for. And PsyCop basically swooped in to basically hush it up. And Puharich, you know, openly said that James Randi, who was sort of the point man on this, and I can't wait till he dies because, boy, the stories that will come out when that guy dies are just going to curl people's teeth. Said that he was working for the Pentagon, that he was working for the DOD, that he was on their payroll. And Randy, who loved to sue anybody who looked at him sideways, you know, never sued Puharich for that, probably because Puharich had the paperwork on it. So anyway, PsyCop was absolutely created because the agenda was to force people into two camps, either the fundamentalist materialists or the fundamentalist materialist fundamentalists. When you look at it, fundamentalism is incredibly materialist. It's not spiritual at all. You know, it really isn't. You know, when you look at the whole idea of people like Jerry Falwell and stuff, there's no spiritual or supernatural. It's all political.
Okay, so that's another question I want to ask, because what I continue to notice, and this could be a projection of fears in one sense, but what always strikes me is when the fundamentalist Christians, or really any fundamentalist religion, when there's a fear of the esoteric, the idea that there's these magicians or these, you know, Freemasonic sorcerers controlling the country, what always amazes me is the idea that they assume that someone else's religion actually has power, whereas I don't see them giving that same power to their priests.
Well, that's just divide and
conquer,
right?
You just answered your own question.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. It's not really a question. It's more of a point. But I want to say, it's like, I guess my question here is that they're obviously not spiritual. They obviously don't feel empowered in any way. But I guess my question comes down to, is it that the Christians who feel like they're being attacked by the atheists, or the atheists who feel the need to attack spiritualism, is it a two-pronged attack, or is it sort of like, you know, the enemy of my enemy, so they'll team up against the esoteric stuff?
It's basically fear is the ultimate form of mind control.
Yeah.
It's the most effective form of mind control. See, this is why I just, when I see a lot of these stories about MKUltra, I just know that they were up to something else, because, you know, the most effective forms of mind control have been known for thousands of years. And if you listen to, you know, any fundamentalist radio station for more than an hour, you are going to hear, you know, literal mind control. And it's all the techniques are there, and it's just putting people into such a position of total disempowerment, just piling up the fear upon the fear upon the fear upon the fear, and then offering this little carrot, this tiny little sliver of light, and that's all you get. It's doled out. parceled out. And I don't really believe that these people think it's real, because everything about their entire worldview and their entire behavior contradicts that. You know, they don't act like people who believe in the life eternal or in supernatural salvation or anything like that. But they are so riddled with fear and terror that they feel that they have no choice. You know, again, this is a system that has broken down. And I think it's like the carnival has moved on. I don't think it's necessarily a natural evolution. I think that the money and the infrastructure is being moved overseas because it's needed elsewhere. And it has to do, I think it really has to do with good factory workers. You know,
yeah, when
you
want
people to do repetitive, mind-numbing work for very low wages, you need to control them. You know, you need to have very, very tight control over their minds. And I think that that's why, you know, fundamentalism always came along with, you know, big finance. I mean, really, the fundamentalist movement was started by Unocal, which is one of the oil monopolies. That's literally true. The modern fundamentalist movement in this country was started by an oil company. That's not speculation. That is literal truth in the 1920s. And then, like I said, in the when that program started to weaken after the war, it got another boost with John Foster Dulles and William Randolph Hearst, you know, who had Billy Graham. They had a new star. And when that started to weaken at the end of the 60s, that's when the TV evangelists came in. You know, but now, what's going on? We don't need low wage, low skilled workers in this country anymore. The economy needs highly skilled workers. It needs cognitive skills, and fundamentalism does not go along with cognitive, you know, knowledge based work. And that's exactly why it's being moved overseas. It's being moved over to Africa, because Africa is this huge continent with massive amounts of resources. You know, and that's why there's this huge war going on right now between Christian fundamentalism and Islamic fundamentalism, you know, particularly in countries like Kenya and Nigeria.